Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Todd Gitlin, an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of the Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and the author of Undying, a novel. His latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Gitlin.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And just to start with the Vietnam War, because it's what's come into focus now for me and for the audience, because we've been talking about it in the last few days, particularly since Paul Ryan was chosen as the vice president on the Republican ticket and may well become the next vice president of the United States. He seems to be the kind of continuum of something that happened in 1972, the famous Powell memo that was in large part a response to the Vietnam War and the protesters. The Supreme Court Justice Powell lived next door to the head of the Chamber of Commerce. They were appalled by the anti-war movement and the fact that students were dropping out, and they wanted to correct the course and have a whole generation of young Americans instilled in with corporate values and right-wing ideology, and they set about it with funds from billionaires and big corporations to set up think tanks, etc. And they've been incredibly successful. And in many ways, Ryan is a product of this machinery that has basically changed the course of American history. Now, I know it's a long-winded preface, but the question is, the anti-war movement that you were a big organizer of, as soon as that war ended, it went away. So I see that as an amazing paradox, that this massive movement that mobilized disappeared, but the movement in reaction to that massive movement has basically taken over America.
Well, this is a very big subject. The I think the starting point for appreciation of the dilemma is to recognize that the right, roughly speaking, is unambivalent about power, and the left is ambivalent about power. The left of the new left of the 1960s wanted reforms, but it was very much a self-starting, self-inventing movement. It aspired to be, as the phrase goes, the change it wanted. And in other words, there was a counter-institutional edge. We don't like the way the welfare system works. We don't like the way public housing works. We don't like the way the professions are organized. We're going to do it our own way. There's a grassroots insurgent up from below self-invention, if you will, social entrepreneurial edge there. And this means that that left, and we see its extensions today in the Occupy movement, which I've more recently written about, the emphasis is on self-creation, on what we ourselves can do or be for each other, rather than the taking of power. And in fact, there's an active allergy. There's a sort of self-immunization against power. So the left didn't, you know, it was not only ambivalent about authority from others, it was also ambivalent about its own authority. And thus, again, you see this played out in spades in the Occupy movement, which is, of course, averse to making demands and having designated leaders and structures and so on. the, you know, Paul, but I think there's actually a bigger story here about the right. You know, that America's been living on borrowed capital and productivity, and the string was running out already in the early 70s during that Lewis Powell period you talk about. The world of Paul Ryan is a world that got dislodged. And, you know, he himself, I mean, it's important to understand him as a devotee of Ayn Rand, but it's also important to understand him as the scion of a very successful, very prosperous, leading family of his small town. These are precisely the people whose world has been undermined by the entrance of minorities, the entrance of women into the larger social world, the infringements, as they understand it, of government in the free operations of their corporate operations. This is a very large company that he is a bearer of. Somebody was, by the way, parenthetically, somebody was asking today, how come he has all this money if he's only been in Congress for 14 years, never worked in the private sector? Well, the answer is he inherited most of it. So these are proprietors. He is the embodiment. He's almost like a character out of C. Wright Mills' Power Elite, published in the 50s. He's one of the possessed who fears being dispossessed. So in this sense, it's a very old story here. The right are those who have and who fear losing. That's a bit oversimple, but not altogether wrong.
Well, that may be the case of Paul Ryan and the Republican politicians, and indeed Romney himself. But the people they get to vote for them are blue-collar Reagan Democrats, the Joe the Plumbers, who don't literally have a damn thing to their name, but yet vote against their own interests. That's the genius of the Republicans. And you know, Ryan is coming across as a blue-collar guy. And by the way, I did a piece yesterday, Todd, the source of his, most of the money, this $8 million that they've declared, most of it comes from the wife, whose father handles the oil and gas leases for Dan Boron, the congressman, who's the son of the former senator of Oklahoma. They're huge in the fracking business, in fracking for gas.
Yes, I saw that. Well, also, he inherits, Paul Ryan himself, from his mother, and she's the heir of the family construction business.
Well, of course, this is pales to the Romney fortune, right? About which we don't know very much.
We're all paled by that.
Yeah, because he won't release his taxes.
Our pallor shows. But what you say is, of course, true. And the Republican Party has been the party ever since the Southern Strategy, which brought the Republicans to power in 1968. The Republicans have been the beneficiaries of the white working class vote that would prefer to be in alignment with the wealthy corporate class than to be at home with racial minorities and the children of immigrants. So the white vote, the white male vote in particular, has been steady, roughly 55% for the Republicans since the 70s. That doesn't change. The only reason Barack Obama was able to win was that, of course, the complexion of the country quite literally has changed, and the white vote ain't what it used to be. Once again, the right built an alliance of both cultural and economic interests, which was more compendious, more retentive, more emotionally satisfying, and more, of course, able to engage the passions of voters who were most reliable, who were most likely to turn out. And turnout, of course, remains a major decisive factor in our elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Todd Gitlin. He's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of Students for Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a novel. His latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. By the way, apropos your book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeal of a Divine Election, Todd, preceding you today is Gideon Levy, who writes for Haaretz, the major newspaper in Israel, and was the spokesman for Shimon Peres. He is unbelievably pessimistic, as is most of his colleagues in journalism in Israel. They're convinced that Netanyahu is going to attack Iran in the fall before the American elections are over. I mean,
Yes, I read Gideon Levy. I respect him. He knows. I would say my most gloomy friends are Israelis these days. Although I just, I don't know what to expect. It could very well be hideous. But I do think it's interesting that I just saw today that 60% of Israelis are actually against attacking Iran, which is kind of startling.
Well, Gideon was saying that the more that they learn about the consequences of thousands of rockets raining down on them, the more, for a long time, the majority have wanted an attack on Iran, but he felt
we can always hope for sanity.
Right. That's pretty much. But anyway, let's get back to the subject of your latest book, Letters to a Young Activist.
By the way, there is an Israeli angle here, too, that's sort of interest. There was this huge movement that erupted in Israel a year ago for domestic reallocation of funds and housing and so on, and it dissipated. It left no political trace, and that is there's actually an issue. It dovetails with the issue we were just talking about. There's a way in which those who believe in power, those who actually relish the use of power, organize to take and hold power. And those who are devoted to protest have a different cast of mind. They often feel more comfortable being outsiders than they're capable of imagining themselves as insiders. And that means that they're not serious about organizing for power. So it comes to pass that this immense movement that attracted the largest demonstrations in Israeli history, and of course was problematic and limited in a lot of ways, and certainly was not, I think, by any means adequate to the ongoing scandal and outrage of the occupation. But it dissipated without leaving a political trace. There's no party that represents it. There's no political strategy that furthers it. This is a perpetual problem for the left in our time. And we can see a similar, I think, flaw in the sort of Occupy-related movements in Europe. You have the Indignados in Spain, who are a wonderful and thrilling sort of incandescent burst of political energy, but have no place in the political structure. We're living in a time when people on the left are enormously and reasonably ill-disposed toward the political classes, don't believe in them, don't think they're competent, don't think that they're honorable, don't trust them. And yet, the alternative is blurry. The alternative it lacks concreteness. And it means that the spirit, which is manifest, for example, in the Occupy movement, it surges up and then it dissipates. Now you see it, now you don't. Whereas the Tea Party, by contrast, is now the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Right. They took 65 seats. The Karl Rove and Company and the Kochs poured the money in, and the political organization translated directly into political power.
And
whereas
Paul
the
Ryan
Occupy
is
movement.
Their guy.
And Paul Ryan's their guy, and they're running with the ball. Conversely, the Occupy movement feels that a plague on all their houses. They probably hate the Democrats more than the Republicans. At least that's what I see mostly on the far left in this country. Is the first instinct on people on the far left in this country is to attack somebody slightly to the right of them rather than the Republicans, who they give a free pass to.
Yes, so this is the well-known circular firing squad on the left.
So here we are trying to sort of inspire people and reverse the tide, and both of us are being pessimistic here. So,
well, I'm more mystic than pessimistic. I think there are a lot of unknowns in consideration now, and I would actually argue. I was thinking that actually the nomination of or the choice of Paul Ryan actually is auspicious. And my reasoning is something like this. I think it increases the chances that Obama is reelected. And I think it's likely now that Obama reelected would actually be a more progressive president, more vulnerable to the Occupy and Occupy-like insurgencies than the first term. Because, first of all, he would not be so tempted by the chimera of bipartisanship. Secondly, he would have to try to do more through executive orders and whatnot, and he would, there would be no impediment to his taking seriously the sort of I would say implicit demands, not of the Occupy movement itself, which doesn't espouse demands, but of some of the forces around it. Like the National Nurses Union, for example, which is a driving force within the coalition to implant a Robin Hood tax on Wall Street transactions, the groupings who are trying to lead a movement for full public financing of elections, moves for increased tax progressivity, and so on. I think the outlook for all of those is paradoxically better. And therefore, it would be rational and inspired, in fact, for those who came to life during the Occupy movement's heyday to understand that they'll play on a more beneficial ground if Obama is reelected president.
So what about, though, getting to that point, which is getting Obama reelected? In many ways, it seems that Romney is still trying to shore up his base, and that's why he chose Ryan, because he didn't really have the Tea Party on board, and now he has them on board. So he's not even at a point where he's trying to win over the swing voters in the center, who are supposedly what really matters in American elections. I think, conversely, you could make the case that maybe Obama doesn't really have his base so secure, because the young people in particular who voted for in 2008, and, you know, obviously we've got to add into the equation the 5 million people that the Republicans have scrubbed off the rolls through voter suppression. How would you compare the Republicans to the Democrats in terms of their base? Because, you know, you're making the assumption that Obama's going to get reelected. Well, you appear to be.
Well, the polls, which are now able to ask with some reliability who's a likely voter as opposed to a registered voter, register a majority for Obama rather regularly. That's now the norm, and it hasn't moved. In fact, it's moved a bit, a point or two toward Obama in the course of the summer. And in the swing states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, Virginia, that tendency is also alive. They're fighting now about 5% or so of undecided voters. And it's true that turnout is a big issue, and that's why Republican efforts at vote suppression have to be resisted so resolutely. But I think it will be difficult for Romney and Ryan to now re-present themselves as ordinary, moderate, old-fashioned Republicans. I mean, they're now to the right of Bush on most issues. And by the way, we were talking for a moment about the prospect of war. The Romney people are neocons. And so on all these grounds, I think I'd much rather be in Obama's shoes now than Romney's.
Well, what's so odd about Romney, of course, is that he probably isn't very ideological at all. He's a businessman, but he's chosen such an ideological running mate, and his campaign has moved so far into the ideological weeds as a result of pandering that, you know, it's almost as if the vice president in a Romney presidency might be running the show.
it doesn't really matter who he, quote unquote, really is. I mean, one doesn't live the presidency the way one lives a private life. One lives it as sort of the intersection of political forces. And the party that elects him, if he is reelected, is a straight down the line right wing party. He will have very, very little room to maneuver.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Todd Gitlin.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communications at Columbia University. He's a former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, the author of Undying, a novel, and his latest book just out is Letters to a Young Activist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.